Open your eyes and hear the magic. Universal Pictures announces the most dazzling romantic musical fantasy in years. Xanadu. Starring Olivia Newton-John, Michael Beck, and Gene Kelly. Xanadu. It's a love story about a boy and girl from two very different worlds whom no one can keep apart. It's a spectacular entertainment that will transport you beyond your dreams. Xanadu, where time stops and the magic never ends. Xanadu.
To the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And coming back to the show is the most requested returning guest star I've ever had, my pal, Laura Mank. Hi, Laura.
Hello. Thank you for having me again. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you for coming back. And I am not lying. You are the most requested return guest star I have had. I've gotten a bunch of emails from people saying, when is that roller derby girl coming back?
This means so much to me, and I'm not kidding you, because I know your audience are people who actually know film and genres and important things like that. And I'm like, I like roller skating, you know. So I really appreciate you all allowing me to visit your world, and don't hate the fact that I don't know much about the art of film as you all do.
Well, it doesn't matter, because again, we're here to talk about roller skating. Now, my idea for to have Laura come back was there's a bunch of roller skating movies. We talked about Kansas City Bomber starring mm-hmm. Raquel Welch, and I was like, well, let me find another roller boogie movie. And there's a couple. There's Skate Town USA, and there's Roller Boogie with Linda Blair. Yeah. I have not seen either one of those movies. And then I realized there's a place where nobody dared to go. It's a love that we came to know. What do they call it, Laura?
Xanadu.
They call it Xanadu. We're here to talk about the 1980 infamous movie, Xanadu. And we'll talk a little bit about how its infamy is, I don't think, very, very deserved, actually. But the thing that charms me about this is, after I asked you, do you want to talk about Xanadu? And you said yes, which was great. You sent me a picture. Which yes. is one of the greatest things anyone's ever sent me. So please explain to everybody what this picture was that you sent me.
Well, you know, in this journey, since we talked about doing this, for me, obviously, the love of this movie is nostalgia on many levels. But what you have is the first documentation. As you know, I am very big into vintage clothing and lifestyle and all that. And so this movie came out in 80. We saw it in the theater. And out of all of the scenes that I could have come home that night to recreate, the ones in the movie that charmed me and grabbed me were the retro scenes with Gene Kelly.
Right,
and
right.
That the outfit she wore, the little military outfit in the dance scene with Gene Kelly, Whenever You're Away From Me. I came home, and I think I did a bang-up job of recreating that outfit.
Oh, you absolutely did. It looked spot on.
Out of paper, and I colored it with green crayon or markers and things like that. And so, yeah, I had that picture, and I put it together with the identical with her in the film. And And it's what we see there is it's, I've carried it throughout my life. I can trace that to that picture, I think.
That's fantastic. If you went to a Comic-Con, you could totally just be like, I do Xanadu cosplay. And it's no weirder than any of the other stuff that people dress at. So it totally worked. I was like, oh my God, I have struck gold here. That not only does Laura want to talk about Xanadu because it's got roller derby in it, but she cosplayed it in 1980. That was just fantastic. So
did. And I did it the first thing I did when I saw, because apparently it was a little bit of Olivia Newton-John thing too, because we saw Grease, obviously, and sure. I came that night and I tried to cut my hair like hers and got in all sorts of trouble for that because I didn't do a very good job. Ended up with no bangs.
Oh, no.
So, you know, what was that, like 78-ish, 79?
Yeah, Grease was 78, yeah.
78, and so then 2 years later, I come home from the movie, I did it again, and this time it worked.
That's fantastic. It was wonderful. Yeah, for anyone who doesn't, not familiar with this movie, as I said, it's from 1980. It's a fantasy musical romance directed by Robert Greenwald, stars Olivia Newton-John, as we talked about, also features Gene Kelly in his final film, and Michael Beck from The Warriors, which is sort of a weird way to go from The Warriors to this movie. And the plot, such as it is a struggling artist named Sonny Malone, which is Michael Beck, lives in Los Angeles, meets a mysterious young woman named Kira, Olivia Newton-John, of course. It turns out that Kira is one of the nine muses of Olympus, who happen to look just like the musical group The Nine Sisters, whose album cover Sonny has just had to paint for his job at a record shop called Airflow Records. Sonny meets an old man named Danny, Gene Kelly, a former big band leader now turned construction mogul. Danny talks about losing his muse in the 1940s, who, in a flashback, we see looks a lot like Kira, and the two form a friendship and decide to renovate an old auditorium and turn it into a nightclub. Sonny falls in love with Kira, and they realize that a mural of the nine muses painted on the side of the auditorium is a portal to Kira's home, a magical place called Xanadu. Kira's parents, the Greek gods Zeus and Mnemosyne, I forget exactly how you say that, are upset that their daughter has fallen in love with a mortal, since Kira is just supposed to inspire mortals. Will Sonny and Kira get to stay together? That is the question put forth in 1980's Xanadu. Now, okay. This movie is legendarily like a giant flop, supposedly one of the worst movies ever made. And I went into it with that kind of in mind. But I watched this movie, and I got to say, Laura, I don't think it's a great movie, but it's not that bad.
And, you know, bad apparently is relative and changes. Seems like a lot of the movies I love, people say are bad. And I'm like, really? Because I love it. I don't, you know, if you can go back to that moment at the time, maybe grown-ups thought it was bad, but it represented, for you know how we connect to things, especially in our formative years, like that was the quintessential everything that was awesome to me at the time. Mm-hmm. I even looking at it over and over again through the years, I can see, like, you know, especially now as a grown-up, like some of the writing and the lines that I go, oh, I can see how that's a little cringeworthy. Or the effects, you know, I saw that when it opened, that weird neon glow thing that encircles everybody.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess I see now why some people thought it wasn't great. But I think, you know, the whole sum of it is still makes it a great movie.
I think the reason people enjoy, first of all, I mean, it was a flop. It was like a big financial flop. And that's always easy to kick somebody when they're down. But I think the reason this movie, people turned on it so to me disproportionately viciously, is because it wears its heart on its sleeve. It's not ironically distant. I mean, like, Grease was a conscious throwback to sort of 50s musicals, but it had that wink of modern times because there was kind of like, you know, there were some like dirty lines in it. So like it was kind of kidding a little bit about the style. This movie from the opening credits, which is a series of old style title cards from a Universal picture. It shows like the plane going, first of all, it's in black and white, and it shows, you know, the plane going around. Like it's the old style 1940s Universal film logos. This movie is in the best way square. It's not trying to be hip or fun. It's totally a retro musical. And it has those 80s effects you mentioned, like when the nine muses blast and it looks like something out of Flash Gordon. So it's a little bit of a weird mixture, but this movie is so kind of unsarcastic, and it's just genuine, and it has its heart on its sleeve. And I think when a movie does that, it invites more cynical people to want to dump on it. And I think that's kind of the thing. Because I look, Olivia Newton-John, one of the great, I'd say one of like the great musical screen presences there ever had. The problem was she was not that much of an actress. And I think you needed a really good director to bring it out in her. And Robert Greenwald, who did a couple of movies and then has since had a second career as a kind of like documentary muckraker. He does a lot of super liberal documentaries about like Fox News and Walmart and all this stuff. So he, this thing really kind of like, it didn't end his career as a dramatic narrative director, but he didn't, never really, this was his big chance and it didn't go anywhere. But I don't know, like Olivia Newton-John, every time she comes on screen, the movie just lights up because she is just so luminous in this movie.
And really, any, even when you see her now, like, I mean, she just has that presence.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's so accessible. And I was, that's why I'm kind of a little surprised. Like, I'm assuming at the time she, maybe she wasn't a great actress, but I would think people, when they go into this movie, like, you can't help but like her, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Connect with her. And she is radiant. I, in a way, could we see anybody else really doing that role?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the big issue I have with this movie, actually, of the three leads, is Michael Beck. Michael Beck, and he's a good actor. Again, he was in The Warriors, which is a great cult movie. But he is such a stiff here. And to me, he just does, I don't really buy that he's in love with Olivia Newton-John. Like, to me, they don't have much chemistry. Gene Kelly looks kind of lost trying to act against him. Like, I just think Michael Beck was the wrong choice. And apparently, I was doing some research on this movie, of course. They offered the role, of course they did, to John Travolta. Because they were like, well, hey, we could just do Grease again. And he turned it down.
Twist of Fate, because when did they do Twist of Fate? Was that after Xanadu?
Two of a Kind, which is a 1980, which was in 1983. And that was not a musical. And that was a giant flop. Because, again, I think you, like, there's nothing wrong with having an actor where you figured out is this is what they're best at. Like Esther Williams, there's a famous quote about Esther Williams. Some studio mogul said, on land, she's not much, but wet, she's a star. And yeah. To me, it's like when you watch Olivia Newton-John do these numbers, you mentioned Whenever You're Away From Me, which is the retro number with Gene Kelly. She's super charming. And when she sings Xanadu at the end, she looks fantastic.
And I did love the musical numbers. I mean, some of the stuff, this, and even now, like the dialogue, when they're like Sonny and Kira are talking, like that is not the part that I get excited about. And it probably is because the chemistry or the writing or whatever. But when the musical numbers kick in, I'm like, yeah. And that goes not just for them, but any of them in the film, I think, are just so crazy, over the top. I'm like, there were people on drug trips or something at that time.
I'm sure there were.
because I love how crazy they went with some of those. It's definitely the musical numbers are I think they're outstanding.
Yeah, it's interesting that this movie does mix styles, because at one point there is quite literally two musical numbers cut back and forth. And one is this retro 40s thing where everybody's looking like it's from 1945 and they're singing kind of like a boogie-woogie Bugle Boy type style. And then they cut back and forth to that to a number from The Tubes, which was this new agey kind of proto-punk band. And they're in like the makeup and it looks like something out of like a dance musical version of Mad Max. And so like I could see maybe in 1980 people were like, What is this? Like, what am I watching? It seems such a weird mix of styles. So I think if they had cut all the 80s stuff, that would have been just fine. All the stuff where it's just Olivia Newton-John or Gene Kelly dancing and singing together, I actually really liked it all. And so I really think that's what it is. It's like people just were like just baffled as to what this was. And I think Olivia Newton-John, not particularly an actress necessarily, she's more of a presence on screen, she's a musician, I think giving her the heavy lifting of playing like a Greek goddess is probably not the greatest thing to do. When she was Sandy in Greece, she's like a regular person. But when you're like, it's tough for any, I mean, have Meryl Streep try and play a Greek goddess, how well would that work, and yet you're giving all this to Olivia Newton-John. That's probably a lot to ask from her.
No, that would make total sense. And I was kind of surprised. I mean, I know that it's about her, and they kept the cast really small. There's not a lot of people.
No.
But being as the Muses are sisters, I always kind of wanted to know more about the other sisters. I wish they'd been a little bit more involved. And I guess that's more like character development stuff. But I was always curious about that.
Right. They're kind of just, they're kind of like, nameless in the background. One of them is played by Sandel Bergman from Conan the Barbarian. That's the only other one detail I found about one of the muses. Like, she went on to other things.
Oh, that's so funny. I love that. I would have liked to have seen her interaction. Maybe that would have provided a bit more up for her to work with besides just being with Michael Beck. Maybe.
Right. If you had a better idea of what the nine muses were about, they're mostly just silent and they dance around and they between the Olivia Newton-John songs or the ELO songs, like they don't get a whole lot to do. One thing I wanted to mention is when the film opens up is that Sonny is this frustrated artist, right? So we find out when he goes to work at this record store that he works at. Okay, this is what Sonny's job is. His boss hires him. The boss is played by an actor named James Sloyan, who you've seen in a million movies. He was in Buck Rogers, Star Trek The Next Generation, Wonder Woman, Star Trek DS9. He's a veteran character actor. He plays the boss, and he hires Sonny and these other artists to do giant size recreations of album covers that already exist. So they're going to hang them in the window to sell the records. And I'm like, that is the craziest job I've ever heard. For the amount of effort and cost it would take to make giant painted versions of album covers just to sell a couple more records. I'm like, no wonder the record business went out of business. That's so not cost effective.
But I do remember, like, I grew up in Fort Collins, Colorado, and we had a store called Rocky Mountain Records and Tapes. And they did that. The store was on a corner lot, and on each side was like three giant record covers that they would paint, so six probably total, and it would take up their whole building on each side. And so when the town and I'd see that and like his job, that was totally made sense to me.
That is nuts. That seems like the most labor intensive job to have, to just, again, with, I mean, it would probably cost hundreds of dollars in man hours to have these people paint these records. And what are you going to do? Oh, we sold a couple more Doobie Brothers this week. Like, really? Is that worth it? It seems like, I don't know, maybe I get used to, obviously it was a thing. I mean, I kind of remember that too. I'm old enough to remember record stores and they did have that, but it's like, boy, somebody just get a photocopier for Pete's sakes. I mean, this is nuts. This is a crazy way to do it. So, I mean, we get the whole thing that Michael Beck, Sonny is this, you know, he's this frustrated artist. Now, there was an adaptation of this movie in another form. We'll get to that later on. That gets more into the details that Sonny apparently in the script, which was left out on the finished version of the movie, is that we find out that Sonny painted the mural of the Nine Muses. So there's more of a connection to him and the Nine Muses that somehow his painting opened up the portal for the Nine Muses to come through. So I'm like, oh, okay. When you see it in the finished movie, there isn't that connection. So it just seems like...
I think it's implied, though.
Right.
I mean, I definitely felt that kind of along the way, that somehow he was connected to that idea.
Right.
And it would have made more sense. So, yeah, they could have, like, shared that somewhere at the beginning.
Right, just a line or two of dialogue would have done it. It's very interesting, all the crazy stuff in this movie, because, like, first of all, Gene Kelly is playing the same character that he played from the 1944 musical Cover Girl, which technically makes Xanadu a sequel, which is crazy. And it's kind of a loose remake of a 1947 movie called Down to Earth, where Rita Hayworth played a muse who inspires a mortal man. So, I mean, this movie, as I said, is like totally playing that old school Hollywood thing on its sleeve. And I guess it was, again, the combination of the 40s stuff and the 80s stuff that people just didn't quite cotton to. Now, you said you liked all that stuff when you were a kid. It was the 40s stuff that really appealed to you.
Exactly. And even though this was, you know, I guess it was really more representative because it was filmed late 70s.
Right.
To 80. It was simultaneously very familiar, and it was all the things that as a young girl, you know, that you're drawn to: the colors, the glitter, the 80s music, the, you know, all that. But yes, I can attribute my love of retro and vintage because my dad was a record collector of 45s. He loved 50s culture. He loved vintage culture. So as I was growing up, obviously that seed was planted. But yes, every time I'd see like you mentioned, the opening credits and the black and white and the plane, like that just grabbed me right away.
Interesting.
So it was simultaneously familiar and fun and what I was into as a preteen or whatever, but it gave me all those things that I loved. I mean, I can even remember doing like a karaoke lip sync thing in high school, and everybody was doing some sort of hair band songs, and I got up and did a whole sequence of 1920s to 30s, like vintage radio ads.
Oh my goodness.
And I made one of those big fake microphones.
Oh, right. The thing, you're right. The size of a small car. Yeah.
Dressed like an Andrew sister and stuff like that. So yeah. So the 40s stuff, I love from the opening sequence on in Xanadu. And every time, you know, Gene Kelly would come on the screen, it was representative of that. And so I got really excited.
Did you get inspired to go track down other movies from the time after you saw? I mean, it was harder to do in 1980, but did you go and find all that other kind of older stuff?
Not really. I mean, I think we watched it more whenever things were on TV.
Right, sure.
Because, you know, at that time, it wasn't even, I don't know. I feel like HBO was new then or something. I don't.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But, you know, when those sort of things would come on, we would definitely want to see it. And so it wasn't until later, once I had more access to things, that then I was just like, oh, you know, I want it all. Or, you know, but, or dress like those things too. So, it was amazing. And I think one of the big, another tie-in, because not only is this a musical and it references the 40s, the big thing that it was drawing in the 70s is the roller disco.
Right. I wanted to get to that. I wanted you to rate the roller derby in this movie. What is your assessment of the quality of the roller derby presented in Xanadu?
Well, very different, obviously, because it's roller disco, not roller derby. So it's not the sport. But at that time, you know, every Saturday, me and my little school friends, we'd go to the roller rink with the pink satin jackets and stuff like that. and hopefully wait for the boy you like to ask you on a little couple skate.
Oh,
you
know, my goodness.
You'd hold hands. And so that was a huge part of my existence that I loved seeing that on the film. And I had not seen any other roller disco, roller dance type films up to that point. And I thought it was great. It's a great representation of the Southern California roller skating world, not, you know, roller disco, as well as the whole Venice Beach scene, which still exists today, and roller dance. And there's actually a really great group of roller derby skaters. There's a woman who created a company called Moxie Roller Skates that they went back to a more traditional skate boot sort of thing versus derby skate. And you can see them out there on Venice Beach where a lot of Xanadu was filmed.
Right.
They're in the shorts and they're doing the tricks and they're doing the dance skating to this day. So it's still very alive and well, and it's awesome to see. So yeah, I feel like roller skating has come in and out of fashion, but I think they did a great job representing it in the movie. And as a derby girl, like when you become a derby skater, not everybody loves Xanadu, but we did still watch it a lot. A lot of us watched it. You know.
It definitely has a sense of place. I mean, you talk about the Southern California, you know, you definitely feel that. I mean, you see there's constantly people kind of zipping back and forth in the background. And I mean, the whole idea of Gene Kelly's character and Michael Beck's character are going to renovate the auditorium. I mean, that's right out of like the Andy Hardy movies. You know, hey, let's put on a show. Let's turn the barn into a stage. I mean, so it has that kind of feel. So it does have a sense of place. I mean, part of it is sure that it was easy for them to shoot because it was right outside the lots. But nevertheless, it definitely has that feeling to it. And Gene Kelly, I think, is a nice, you know, and we see pictures of him as a younger man. I love any kind of movie that harkens back to a previous time, because it's funny that you talk about that, you know, the way you discover stuff. And I wonder, we're getting off Xanadu a little, but I wonder about what current generations are going to do when stuff is only watched, I'd say nowadays, because you choose to watch it, as opposed to stuff just being on, and you are more like, oh, what's this? Because I think about, you talk about how much you love the 40s, I do too, and I discovered the 40s as like a concept through Abbott and Costello movies that were on UHF, like on Sunday afternoons, and I was like, you know, this was a portal to another, much like the portal in Xanadu, it was a portal to like another world of like, wow, what is this? Like, what are these fashions and who are they talking? Roosevelt, who's that? Who are they talking about? And it just entranced me as a kid. And I would never have watched Abbott and Costello movies on purpose, you know, if I was like on if I had Netflix as a 10-year-old, I'd be like, I don't want to watch this. That's old. But because I was watching television on Sundays at 1 o'clock, I just watched what was on. And it became a big part of my life. And so I wonder, like, how's that going to, you know, are kids nowadays discovering stuff the way they used to, the way we used to?
Exactly. And I think some of the greatest moments in our lives of any, whether it's entertainment or not, are the accidental, unexpected discoveries. And I don't know in terms of entertainment, like, I don't see younger folks necessarily having that. I have a sister who's grown up in this age of, you know, the cell phones and all that, and they don't even have TV. They just have cable, you know, they don't have cable. They just have Netflix or streaming or things like that. So you're right. It's going to be, I don't know if people will stumble across things sometimes unless people talk about it,
right,
or
right,
read
right.
something online and they go search it out. But I, one of the films that I came across as a, in like later teens by accident, I remember coming across The Big Sleep. It was kind of a, you know, mature film or whatever, but I remember it was just on, and then it was like, oh my God, in these pantsuits. What?
There's no roller derby in this at all.
There's no roller derby in this, but I loved it. I was like, I gotta, you know, it opened up a kind of that genre to me. So I don't ever want to be so nostalgic that I poo-poo anything. It's just things change. But yeah, I mean, I think it's nice when you just kind of come across something that surprises you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what life this might have had on television. The movie's rated PG, so there's nothing really offensive in it in terms of language. There's no, the sex is non-existent. It's a very, the relationship that Kira and Michael Beck's character, Sonny, have is like very chaste. It's like they kiss each other, which is, again, probably perfect for a girl your age to see, because it's sweet and romantic, and it's very similar to what you're talking about. It's like you're hoping the boy will hold your hand at the roller derby kind of thing.
Yep, exactly. And I was trying to think about like why even it was PG, and I guess maybe some of the like a few words at the time were a little, you know, monitored, or the suggested dancing maybe. On the big thing. I was like, what made? Because now it's different. But I was just like, wow, it was a PG.
Probably the tubes number by itself probably got them a PG, just because the tubes looked scary or something, you know, they had a slight punk edge to them at the time, so maybe that was, you know, they're like, all right. Plus nobody wanted a G rating, because you knew that it was like, oh, that's Disney films are for, you know, that's for Disney movies, it's gonna be the kiss of death if we give this thing a G rating. So what do you think of the dance numbers aside from the roller derby? What do you think of the dance stuff in it? That's one of the criticisms I had, and is that the dance numbers are all, again, they're directed by Robert Greenwald, they're all shot from really far away. So they don't have a lot of, like, immediacy. They're just kind of like a bunch of people, tiny people in the background just kind of moving around. You don't get that, like, really, like, Olivia Newton-John gets lots of close-ups. But yeah. When the other dancers, like, it's all just kind of a big mob that dances in the background. I don't know. Did you feel that way?
You know, at the time, I don't think even now I would recognize that. Mm. but they do, it is very busy. And like during those scenes, that might be where I might go take a sip of my drink or something like that. Because I'm just taking it. There's not one thing to focus on, and I get that. But it's colorful and there's movement, and you know, and I like the dance scenes, even when they're not, you know, just the modern dance or whatever. Because I try and look, even when I just rewatched it, I would look at, like, kind of focus on somebody in the background specifically and try and watch that one person. Mm-hmm. Because they do blend. It took some effort. But then I'd be like, oh, my God, look at that crazy makeup. Oh, look at that weird spandex bodysuit thing. How is her boob not falling out? Oh, my God. Like, you know, I did spend a little extra time probably trying to really, peer into those scenes. And it was interesting because so many, you know, all the dancers obviously were the same in all the numbers, and some of the muses were in the dance numbers.
Right.
And they just, like, recycled them over and over and over. So it was, I'd be like, oh, that one was this in the other scene, or that one was that one in the other, you know, dance number. So I that's what I was going to talk about. But like, they kept this cast pretty small. They just mm-hmm. kept recycling everybody. They had like three main people, and then everybody else was recycled.
Yeah, yep. I mean, yeah, you talk about, this is a very pretty film to look at. I mean, the Art Deco sets are really mm-hmm. beautiful. And then the scene where Sonny and Kira dance in the roller rink, and he like turns on the lights, and that illuminated background comes up of the cityscape, and she dances around. It's beautiful looking.
I'm not going to lie, I would grab my skates and go to that warehouse in 2 seconds. That's like the most awesome gate indoor skating rink idea. I'm like, I want to go there. I want to go grab my skates and go there.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's consciously recalling a scene from Singing in the Rain where mm-hmm. Gene Kelly takes Debbie Reynolds into one of the studio backlot warehouses and flips on the lights, and it's, you know, she's of course a newbie to all of this stuff, and she's just overwhelmed at the spectacle and like what can be created inside of a warehouse, this all this beauty. And so that's what, to me, this scene is recreating, except it's the genders are flipped, because he's showing Kira this warehouse and she's impressed by it, but of course he's also deeply, you know, he's the one falling in love with her because she's this amazing thing. But I mean, the movie is, I mean, and when they dance around, like on all the palm trees come up, all the fake palm trees and stuff, like it's, I don't know, it's really inventive and it's kind of different. It's, I can totally see why if you're an 11 year old girl, or you just, this movie feels like it's everything because it just has all the stuff that I would imagine a kid that age would want.
Exactly. And I was reading this article about neural nostalgia and why we connect to things in our formative years and why that sticks with us and why we still love it, because it does connect in your brain, like that positive thing when you're forming your own opinions and experiencing things on your own outside of what your parents have given you and stuff like that to see. And so that's why, I mean, those things that you connect with, and then it just carries with you. And I'm like, oh, no wonder I still like it. Mm-hmm. You know, I never was like, oh, you know, because you can outgrow things or whatever. But I was like, nope, I've watched it whenever I'd see it on TV and keep it going. And then it was cool because, you know, we actually like lived in Florida at the time when it first came out, and then we moved. And then, you know, 10 years ago, moved to LA. Seeing all of those places, like that movie is really a hardcore love letter to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And like all you can actually, there's an LA Weekly article that some people skated to a lot of those locations. and you can still do that. And the chance to see all that represented, I'm like, that, I'm kind of surprised when you see those lists of things like great films about Los Angeles or great films about Chicago. Like, Xanadu should be on that list.
Interesting. I think people, I always figure those things, like the cutoff is the movie itself has to be considered great. And then you could say, oh, it's also a great movie about Los Angeles. But that isn't necessarily true. A movie can be really great about the location without the movie itself necessarily being all that great. You know, it can have that quality. You know, where you're like, boy, this really feels like this moment. I mean, there aren't a lot of movies that are not mob movies that are set in New Jersey. So I don't have a lot of opportunity to say, boy, that really feels, because, you know, suburban New Jersey is boring. You know, there's nothing to look at. It's all gray and overcast and, you know, it's a bunch of strip malls. That's not fun to look at.
But you know, that's where the real mafioso deals are going down.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, out in the burbs.
That's right. So, but yeah, I mean, this movie has all those things. I mean, this movie even has, for Pete's sake, an animated sequence. It is a whole animated sequence. What did you think about that part?
I forgot about that until I watched it again. And then I was like, wait, what? It was funny. That part, I would say, if out of all of the things, was the one I was a little like, eh. But okay. I mean, at the same time, you know, they both become fish and to birds and, you know, it's the Don't Walk Away song, which, again, the soundtrack, I have it on my phone, okay? It's a great song. So, yeah, the ELO one, it was really fun, actually, when I revisited it. I think maybe at some point I'd blocked it out, just like, okay, that just was too weird even for me. But when I watched it this last time, I was like, oh, fun.
Yeah, they had to jam it in there because they had to add another number, and yeah. At that point it was too late to reshoot a sequence, so they just said, oh, we'll just animate it and make it a fantasy sequence. And you know, there aren't too many movies that could do that, but this movie, you could plausibly, it is weird because all of a sudden the movie becomes animated, but this movie is such a light fantasy that they kind of get away with it, really. I mean, in most other musicals, they couldn't have done that with La La Land, but in this, it's not the craziest thing you've ever seen in this movie.
No, and you kind of get used to the cadence of this is a choppy scene, jumping, you don't know what's coming next, right, kind of movie. Like, they're going to be dancing in a warehouse. Oh, they're going to be skating down Venice Beach. Oh, now they're going to be here. Oh, now they're turning into fish and birds.
Right. Sure. Why not? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. It's okay. And I have to say, I love movies. I've talked about this on other episodes of the show. I love when movies, even if it's not a great movie, really sticks the landing. Because that's hard to do. And this movie has a great final sequence. The final number, which is Xanadu.
Yeah.
And Olivia Newton-John is in like that black outfit. I don't know what the term's called, but it's like it's very like V-neck where like it's
right. It was like a jumpsuit.
A jumpsuit. There, of course, that was the word I was looking for.
A halter neck.
Yeah.
Jumpsuit, if you will.
Yeah, they're perfect. She looks fantastic, and everybody's singing Xanadu. Gene Kelly is on roller skates dancing around. He looks like he's having a great time, and the Xanadu song is flat out terrific. That's a good. I mean, there's a reason why this movie's soundtrack was a massive hit. I mean, the movie maybe didn't make the studio any money, but they made a ton of money off the soundtrack. And the final scene is really genuinely good. And then even going to chop it down even finer, literally the final scene of this movie before the credits, where we think that maybe Kira is gone forever. Yeah. Spoiler alert for everybody. We think Kira is gone forever. And then Sonny and Daniel meet a waitress at this club. And she looks just like Kira. And then we realize, okay, it's probably Kira in another form. They actually, we have Sonny and Kira, or whoever Kira is in this form, start to talk. And their dialogue gets sort of faded out over the end credits. And it's a really interesting directorial choice to let the dialogue fade out as opposed to, no, we have to hear what they're saying. No, it doesn't matter what they're saying because we know they're going to fall in love. I genuinely think that is a great moment. And I love that the movie ends like that. And so, again, for a movie that's not considered that great, I'm like, I've seen 1,000 movies that don't have endings that cool. I love the final moment of this movie.
And it was satisfying because yes. You want a happy ending. And I'm like, okay, I don't care what they're saying. I am just,
yes.
Yeah. Yay. You know, she didn't go back up to Mount Olympus or, you know, wherever and stay there. And I was just like, okay, whatever. They're going to skate off into the sunset.
Yeah. Oh, and she looks, again, that jumpsuit she's wearing is like, it's all sparkly. And her hair is bouncing and behaving. I mean, she just looks like $1 million. I mean, I think if you're a movie after Grease, I could see why you could look at her and say, we got a next big star here. You know, like, I could see why you would think that. And this movie started out actually as a B-level roller disco movie. And then when Skate Town USA and Roller Boogie came out, the studio was like, oh, okay, we have to make this kind of a bigger thing, which it morphed from a, like, a B-level Roller Boogie movie into this big grand musical. And so they never intended to spend this kind of money, but they did, because once Gene Kelly and Olivia Newton-John attached themselves to it. Except, I don't want to say this. I don't think this is a particularly great movie, but it is not, like, some disaster. And apparently this film inspired, like, the Raspberries, which was, like, some award that some guy did every year for bad movies. And to me, people that spend their time, like, going out of their way to crap on other movies, I'm like, go F yourself. You know, like, to me, put something positive back into the world, not negative. And on top of it, this movie doesn't deserve that. I think this is, you know, like I said, I'm watching it play out in front of me as we're recording, and I'm like, I'm getting all caught up in it. I want to hear Olivia Newton-John sing Xanadu again. I really do.
And that also showcased, you know, when they do all the different genres
right
in that last scene, like, her talent across those genres, that woman can sing.
Oh, it was terrific.
I love the country one. That was also one of my favorites. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Little Love's going to make it right. This movie does have a little bit of a long shadow in that there was a 2007 musical version of it, which is sort of a parody of the movie, where it's kind of like it in, I guess, with the, I've of course never seen it, but I guess within the musical, the film of Xanadu exists in the world of the musical. And the musical was actually nominated for a couple of Tony Awards. People actually thought it was really good. And on opening night, Olivia Newton-John was there, which is, like, good for her. That's great. I'm glad that she's, like, embraced the legacy of Xanadu.
Yeah, I actually saw a stage production of it in LA. And I went, of course, with some Derby friends, Gozer and Susie Snake Eyes. Thanks for taking me.
Great name.
But we had a great, and they, you know, I was really impressed because it's, well, the only other, I don't know if you ever knew about Starlight Express. That was,
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, it was all done on roller skates. It was people on roller skates, and they were trains. And it was very exciting, actually, and I loved it, of course. But then to see a stage production and them all on roller skates, and it got to be challenging. Nobody could tumble, but it was very true to the story of the film and things like that, and it was great. And I'm glad to see that people. I mean, then this was just a couple of few years back. So people are, this is living on, no matter what the reviews were. It's a thing.
That's terrific. You know, I think if you find something that you enjoy, there shouldn't be any reason not to. If you like it, you like it. You know what I mean? And I'm always happy to either discover a movie for the first time or rediscover something. Because I think I did see Xanadu, you know, 20 years ago on videotape or something, because I was just sort of fascinated with, like, oh, this movie's a giant bomb. I didn't remember anything from it. I think I was at the age where I was like, this just doesn't interest me. But so I just dismissed it. So watching it again for the show, I was kind of watching it almost like for the first time. And I was like, okay, I get why this movie didn't really hit, but it doesn't deserve the ignominy that it has. And there's a lot to recommend about it. And again, the music is really catchy. So it's fun. I would say if you have kids who are, like, into being a performer or that kind of thing, get them to watch this movie. I think they like it. It's beautiful to look at. Again, the musical numbers are great. It's a lot of fun. And that's awesome that you and your Dollar, I keep combining the words, roller derby friends went to see a live production. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, of course, anything with roller skates, like, you know, if you ever get, whenever you guys get to come visit, there's a lot of roller skate stuff around here. Just warning you in advance.
All right, good to know. Good to know. I'm completely uncoordinated, but I'm willing to give it a try. So, well, I think that is going to do it for Xanadu. Is there anything else you want to say about it before we wrap up, Laura?
No, thank you for letting me be on this little nostalgic journey with this film and get a chance to talk about it. I have enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for coming back on. I am not, again, you are the most requested return guest. Everybody loved your roller derby episode, the Kansas City Bomber episode, so they'll be thrilled to hear this one. I'm always happy to talk to you. You're one of my favorite people. So this was great to have you back on. And so we'll have to have you back on at some point for Whip It, I guess. We got to talk about Whip It.
Yeah, I would love that. I'll watch it another 100 times before that.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. We'll watch Whip. We'll have you back for that. And we'll do Roller Boogie with Linda Blair. So everybody stay tuned. Normally this is where we end the show, but we're going to play some podcast promos. And we're going to have a second segment where we're going to talk about Xanadu the comic book. Stay tuned.
Do you enjoy movie scores? Do you like science fiction? Do you like fantasy? And do you like movies?
Everything's under control. Situation normal.
What happened?
Had a slight weapons malfunction, but everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Well, I have a podcast for you. Soundtrack Alley. It's a podcast where I take you on a journey through the time of my childhood and beyond to give you a glimpse into the world of movies, science fiction, fantasy, and other films that touch me on a personal level. You'll also enjoy interviews from film composers from famous movies from the past or even current times. Enjoy the interaction I have with guests on my show every so often, and check out other shows that share in guest spots. So sit back, relax, and let the soundtrack world wash over you, and check out Soundtrack Alley. You'll love it.
Hello, everybody. We're back. And as promised, we're here to talk about the Xanadu comic book. And I'm sure many of you listening to this are going, what Xanadu comic book? Not really one of Marvel's more famous publications. They did an adaptation of the movie published in Marvel Super Special number 17. It has got quite an all-star lineup. On the art side, you've got Rich Buckler, Mike Nasser, Brent Anderson, Joe Brzezowski, Al Milgram, and Bill Sienkiewicz, with Glynis Wien and Howard Chaykin and others on color. Editor is Louise Jones, and the writer is our guest, friend of the network, J.M. DeMatteis. Hi, J.M.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you doing this because this was certainly a footnote in your career, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity when I was
And a very done. Weird footnote as well, yeah.
You betcha. I mean, when I decided to do the movie for the show and I was like, oh, I think Marvel did an adaptation, and I dug out my copy and then I realized, wow, JM wrote this. This is crazy. So, again, I appreciate you coming here to talk about this. So how did you end up with this assignment?
You know, this was very, very early in my career. I was probably still, you know, I started out at DC in the very late 70s, and I'd made some inroads with Jim Shooter over at Marvel. I might have written a fill-in or two, but Jim liked my work. So I think this was before, there was a certain point, like in 1980, where I got an exclusive contract with Marvel. I don't know whether Xanadu, I have a feeling Xanadu came before that and maybe overlapped with that. But it's a point in one's career where if they call you up and say, do you want to write on the wall of my apartment? You say yes, because you know what I mean? So you know, if they call up and they say you want to do an adaptation of this movie for a Marvel Super Special, you don't think and say, well, what movie is it? You just say yes when you're a freelancer. And, you know, there's an aspect of freelancing where that almost never goes away. You know, when you get a little more successful, you can refuse certain things. But, you know, there's always that part of it. It's like, if I say no to this, what if there's no work tomorrow, you know?
Right.
In the beginning, when you're that hungry, when Marvel Comics calls and says, you want this gig? You say, absolutely. So I did. And then you discover that what you're writing is an adaptation of a movie. Okay, that's interesting. And then you discover that you're writing an adaptation of a musical. the singing and dancing. And then it's like, you know, that's really, really strange. But you do the gig, and I don't remember a lot about it. I do remember that, you know, they had a draft of the screenplay. I sat down, I wrote a whole adaptation, I turned it in, and then I got a call that said, you know what, they just sent us a brand new draft of the screenplay and you have to rewrite it. And I was so new to the business, I thought I would have to rewrite it and they wouldn't pay me. But they said, no, we're going to pay you to do that. It's okay.
Oh, nice. All right.
And I think one of the reasons you listed all these artists, I think it was one of those jobs where somehow it gets put on the schedule and suddenly it's like, well, how long was it? You would know better than I, because I haven't looked at it in years. It was probably, 48 pages or something crazy like that?
Yes. Yeah.
And suddenly, oh, this has to be out in 60 days, and how are we going to get this done? So, well, we'll have this guy draw 5 pages, and this guy draw 5 pages, and that guy draw 10 pages, you know. So that's, I think, why they had so many artists in on that thing. So it was sort of this big just rush to get this thing out. And in the middle of that, like I said, I had to write a whole different draft because they had changed the movie. Don't ask me how, because I have absolutely no recollection.
Okay, so they had you had no footage to go by. They were just, yeah. You were just the script.
No, I didn't see the movie. I remember they invited us to a screening, but that was after the book was done. Because the book had to come out when the movie came out.
Right.
You know, and usually with these adaptations, it's not like they're sending you footage. I don't know if it's different today because everything is high tech and it's digital. But back then, you know, were they going to ship us reels of film?
Right. Oh, that's true. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
I didn't think about it until just a second, you know. So, no, you got a script and maybe there were some stills or something. I don't even remember that. I just remember the script. But as I said, this is a long time ago, in the very beginning of my career. So it's hard to remember the details.
Do you have any recollection of how you thought to approach of all the movie genres that would lend itself the least to a comic book adaptation, it's the musical. Do you remember how am I going to put across a musical number in a comic book form?
Yeah, I think probably I didn't even worry about it that much at the point. I was just so happy to have the gig. I was going to sit down and do whatever it took. And I'm looking back, I'm thinking, well, they're dancing, so there's movement. And there were all these women on skates and stuff, and so I think it was just about keeping it moving, keeping the visuals moving. Now I don't remember. You tell me. They weren't like singing song lyrics in the comic, right? It was just the story.
Yeah, I mean there are scenes, the musical scenes where you see some of the lyrics like written on kind of like an omniscient narrator type thing, but the characters themselves are not actually singing.
Right. That would have been really weird if they were singing. You know, unless they remember the old when they used to have flexi discs. You know, they could have done that.
Oh yeah, yep.
They could have put a flexi disc in the back with a few of the songs on it. But no. But what I do remember is at least it was a fantasy. So it opened itself up visually, and it was a very visual movie. You know, yes. And with all kinds of crazy 70s disco costumes and crazy. It came out in 1980, I think. Was
yep.
it 80?
Yep, 80.
Yeah, but it was still, you know, very much under the influence of the 70s. I mean, roller skating, discoing, and all that stuff. So you just have to keep it visual and keep it moving and keep them skating as much as you can. You know, and it's funny. I used to say, I'm the only guy who ever drew, you know, wrote a comic with Gene Kelly in, which is funny because years later when I met my wife, she's like the biggest Gene Kelly fan in the world. So that's kind of a good thing to say, hey, I wrote a comic book with Gene Kelly in it, you know?
Factoid to throw at somebody, yeah, too. Yeah.
Except I think Steve Wacker some months back on Twitter, he said, no, you're wrong. And he found I don't know whether it was an adaptation of Singing in the Rain or some other Gene Kelly thing, but somewhere in the 1950s, there was a Gene Kelly comic book that preceded mine. I felt very bad about that. I wanted to be the only guy that had ever put Gene Kelly. Because I love Singing in the Rain is like one of the greatest movies ever made.
Sure.
And I love Gene Kelly. I learned to love him via my wife, who, you know, was a professional dancer and just adored him. But I still, you know, so maybe there were two of us that got to put Gene Kelly in a comic book, you know.
It is Gene Kelly's last film, so you had the last bite at the apple, as it were.
That's right. It's so interesting, too. Do you know who? Of course you do, because you're doing a whole show. Who directed that movie?
The director is a guy named Robert Greenwald, who had a brief career doing, you know, narrative films, and now is more famous as a kind of muckraking documentarian. He does documentaries
Greenwald?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Wow. The guy he directed the Walmart, the high cost of low prices, and
right. No, I know his name. Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder since Gene Kelly, you know, even in all those other movies where there are other directors, he was always directing the dance sequences. I wonder if he had a hand. in directing any sequences for this movie.
Apparently he did. The main dance sequence he has with Olivia Newton-John apparently was choreographed and pretty much just shot by Gene Kelly. Because he, you know, of course you're going to go to Gene Kelly. When you got a musical number, you're going to go to Gene Kelly. Who knows better? The one detail about your adaptation that actually I think is sort of interesting because it improves upon the movie is the whole plot of the movie hinges on this painting that's on the side of the mural that is of the seven muses, and the seven muses come alive, and one of the muses is Olivia Newton-John. Right. In your adaptation, and you just said based on the original script, so maybe this was lost in the editing, is that in your version, it is more clear that the main character, Sonny, painted the mural, which comes alive, and so he sort of is more connected to the seven muses. In the movie, you don't get any sense of that. The mural just exists, so you're kind of like, what does that have to do with anything? So actually, the comic book version has a little more coherence because of the connection.
I suspect that was probably, you know, with movies all the time, they're cutting things and moving things, and because I'm sure if I put it in there, I didn't just make it up. I'm sure it was in the script. So they must have at some point, they could have even filmed it and then just cut that sequence out because they just thought it slowed things down. But it seems like an important plot point, you know?
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Why you would cut that out, I don't know. I don't know.
They said, the lineup of artists here is really amazing. And they said, I imagine that, as you said, as the deadline approached, Marvel had to pull the whole many hands approach and just get as many people on it as possible. I mean, Bill Sienkiewicz, early in his career, man, geez.
Yeah. Well, I guess a lot of us very early in our careers. You know, usually at Marvel, we worked what's called Marvel style, which is plot first, where you write a very detailed plot. It goes to the artist. He or she draws the story. The art goes back to you. Then you do the dialogue and captions. But the Xanadu was done full script, meaning, you know, they gave me the screenplay. I wrote my script beginning, middle, and end. It was all there, and it was just handed off to the artist. So I didn't have to sit around and wait for 10 artists to finish their work and then start dialoguing from there. It was all in my script, which, you know, you couldn't have done a job like that, I don't think, if it was done plot first, especially with a heavy deadline breathing down your neck. Although God knows I've probably done something like that in my career at some point.
I would love to know what Marvel's sales figures were for this, for these adaptations, because sometimes their movie adaptations were real hit or miss. I mean, sometimes they would get something big. I had Conan the Barbarian, of course, but then they would adapt, like I said, Xanadu or Meteor, like some real stinkers.
A lot of weird stuff. I know. I once did an adaptation of the sequel to 2001. It was called 2010.
Yeah, 2010. Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote that one, and then there was, I don't even know the name of it. It was, I don't know why they did it. I don't know who paid somebody off along the way. It was a TV pilot that didn't even go to series, and I'd have to look it up to even remember the name. It was about a cartoonist whose character comes to life, and it was a two-issue miniseries based on a failed TV pilot, okay?
Wow.
So, and if I recall, I don't recall the name, but I recall that it was illustrated by Steve Lealoa, so it looked good too.
Wow!
Why? You know? It could be that could have been when Marvel was owned by New World, and maybe it was a New World pilot at that point, you know. But they did a lot of really weird stuff over the years.
They sure did.
And certainly, why the decision to adapt a musical? Unless, you know, someone somewhere thought this is going to be the biggest thing of this will be to the 80s what Star Wars was to the 70s.
You know,
Skating users, look out. So I don't know. But I have to be honest. I was just grateful to get the work. And because I had to rewrite it, they had to pay me twice. Who could ask for anything more?
Perfect. Yes. As I was a freelancer for many years, getting paid twice is always the ideal situation. Yeah. So.
It's a good thing.
Well, I think that's going to do it. I don't want to waste any more of your time talking about Xanadu. You've written so many legendary things as Spider-Man, Dr. Fate, and Justice League International, Moonshadow, that having you on to talk about Xanadu is to use an analogy that I think you and I both would appreciate. It's kind of like getting a chance to interview Bob Dylan and choosing to ask him about the cameo he did on Dharma and Greg that one time. It's just sort of like, this is really silly. So I very much appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk about this.
Well, since you like to talk about obscure things, next time I'm sure you'll call me up and say, you know, you did a Batman comic book in 1970. It was a coloring book, a Batman coloring book. It was the first Batman story I ever wrote, and I'm sure that's exactly the kind of thing you want to talk about next time.
Challenge accepted.
If you could find it anywhere. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's out there. Absolutely sure it's out there. So
anyway, happy to talk to Rob.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. But why don't you always have like 73 projects going at any one time? Why don't you tell some people about just like say 25% of them at the moment?
Okay, right now, the thing I'm plugging the most is right now, if you go to the CW Seed Network, which is a streaming network which you can get on your computer or your Roku or your Apple TV, I have written a John Constantine animated series. The first 5 episodes are on CW Seed now. There will be 7 more episodes, as well as a DVD Blu-ray movie release with like another 20 minutes of story, a big, great full-length Constantine story, one of the best animation projects I've ever worked on. Really, really happy with the way it came out. I've written recently 3 episodes of Marvel's new animated Spider-Man series. Keith Giffen and I continue to write Scooby Apocalypse. Fred dies this month. I've got a couple of new creator-owned series in the works, one for IDW called Impossible Incorporated, which comes out in September, and then another one, which I can't say what it is. It'll be out early next year that I'm also very excited about because I'm working with I can't even say who I'm working with. But it's so those are just a few of the things that are in force right now with other things circling the airport. So, yeah, keeping busy, keeping creative, and very, very happy with the work I'm doing.
Outstanding. So again, well, thank you. Then once again, everyone who listens to the Fire and Water Podcast Network is a huge fan of you, and you've been nice enough to come on a couple different shows here on the network. So it's always great to talk to you. So
okay,
thank
well,
you so much.
To talk about the next obscure, weird thing that I don't remember that I ever did.
All right, I'm gonna. That's said. Challenge accepted. I'm gonna dig that stuff up, and then we'll do the 2010. We'll do a film and water on 2010, and then we'll do the adaptation.
I'll have even less to say about that.
So of course, if you want to listen to more episodes of the show, go to the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking movies over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So, again, thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.